Hey, wait, wait. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw an eye and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. This is the matter of Sandra K. Hupp versus Nicholson, case number 03-1668. Are counsel ready to proceed? Who will be represented by the appellant?
Yes, sir. I'm Sandra Michelle, representative for the appellant.
All right, Ms. Michelle, you may proceed. Okay, you have 30 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time?
With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Everybody. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Sandra Michelle, attorney for the appellant, Sandra Hupp. She's filed a claim for accrued benefits and for DIC benefits. Her husband, Billy Hupp, served two tours of duty in Vietnam and thus was exposed to Agent Orange during his service. In 1993, he was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia, commonly referred to as CML, and that's how I'll refer to it from now on to avoid tripping over my tongue. In 1993, he also filed a claim for service connection, which was pending at the time of his death in 1999. Now, this case includes a number of issues. There's a lot here. We have a reasons or basis. Did the board give adequate reasons or basis for dealing with the medical evidence that was present? There's a VCAA question, whether adequate notice was presented.
What was the medical evidence present? The 1995 statement?
That's the
2000 statement?
Right. There were actually three 2000 statements. There's a January statement by Dr. McCall, which was basically a review of the VA's circular. There was also a March 2000 opinion by a hematologist saying that there was a journal which referred to some studies which might indicate a connection. And then there was a July 2000 statement, again by Dr. McCall, saying that this journal simply referred to the same studies which were talked about previously. So we really have three. You can kind of lump them together. The two McCall statements, both are pretty much against service connection, and the March 2000 hematologist report is fairly weak but in favor of service connection. It says there may be. However, the 1995 opinion, which is really not dealt with very well, is pretty critical on this issue.
But the board did acknowledge that statement?
They acknowledged its existence.
And did they, in the analysis, compare it or reject it?
They didn't. They never said there was anything wrong with it. They summarized the content of it, and it's a fairly short opinion, so they pretty much just said. The 95 opinion says right there, his CML is associated with Agent Orange exposure. Now, this evidence was, or this opinion was given by a VA physician, and one who apparently does Agent Orange exams for the VA, because the veteran testified in one of his hearings that Dr. Luker was, in fact, the doctor who gave him his Agent Orange physical and compared his situation to that of a number of veterans whom he had previously
examined. Do you know whether or not in the 1995 statement that doctor had the service medical records?
There's no indication whether he did or not.
What about in 2000?
He did.
Right.
However, you know, I would point out that with leukemia, which is a somewhat of a long-tailed type of disease, service medical records are not necessarily going to be particularly dispositive. Because if it's a carcinogen and it causes mutations, it's not necessarily going to show up anything in service. There's also,
if that's the case, then your related argument on the failure of duty to assist, that the secretary failed to secure service medical records that were discussed in the prior board decision, what is the harm in not having secured them if they, in fact, exist, based upon what you just said?
Well, I'm not a doctor. You know, it's a doctor who needs to evaluate this. What I'm saying, though, is I, as a lawyer, not a doctor, I don't believe it's dispositive whether or not the service medical record should have been. That's something a medical opinion would be necessary on. But if, in fact, there were signs while the veteran was in service, if he was having this swelling and so forth, and if that's associated with leukemia, it needs to be considered. And perhaps it was an early symptom. I don't know. That's something a doctor ought to consider.
I believe the doctor in the January 2000 opinion did assume that Mr. Hupp had some swelling of the lymph glands or lymphoma-related incidents, and said even assuming that, that would be unlikely to be related to subsequent development of leukemia.
Correct. But what he said actually was, I have nothing here. There's nothing here to tell me about this at all. But I think it was an acute infection response, not a sign of leukemia. Well, if we're going to talk about pure supposition, we've pretty much got a textbook case. There's nothing given to back that up. Why do we know it's an acute effect? I mean, there's nothing to back that up.
That's so are you arguing that the exam was potentially inadequate?
Oh,
or incompetent without appropriate premise or basis?
I don't think there's an appropriate basis at all for that 2000 opinion. If we'd like, I can go ahead and discuss some of the flaws in that right off the bat. In addition to the fact that Dr. McCall gave absolutely no reasons for this idea that it's an acute infection response, he also doesn't appear to.
Well, he had to base that on just what was on in the record.
Which is nothing. So that means he's just.
Or whatever Mr. Hupp had told the doctor in 1995.
Which he told him he had swelling and no one knew what caused
same
it.
Same with the dermatitis, because he obviously couldn't visually make an examination,
right.
So consequently.
Exactly.
I guess dermatitis would manifest itself soon after exposure to Agent Orange?
I don't think the dermatitis is even really an important issue here.
Well, it was to the 1995 opinion.
Well, he said that he shows the textbook symptoms of Agent Orange exposure,
right.
Including dermatitis. Perhaps, you know, again, we don't know. Perhaps he had dermatitis when Dr. Luker examined him. Dr. Luker actually did examine the veteran and had been treating him. He was not doing a records review. So the veteran was, in fact, being seen by Dr. Luker. And as I said, the veteran pointed out that Dr. Luker did his Agent Orange exam, which is not in the file. I don't know if there was any written record of it, but that was not obtained and put
right.
in the file.
Okay.
So, if in fact, there was an Agent Orange exam, which, you know, there's no reason to believe that the veteran was lying about this, and there is evidence in the record that he was receiving payments from the veteran's Agent Orange program. So, presumably, there was some sort of exam. They wouldn't just give him money on his own say-so. But that hasn't been obtained. One of the things that I think also we need to look at, and I have to apologize for the court, I realized when I was preparing for the argument that I did not adequately cover this at all in the brief, and that's the distinction between the accrued benefits and the DIC claim. And in fact, you know, it's pretty important here that we look at the distinction between the two, because on accrued benefits, we have to look primarily or totally at what was in the file when Mr. Hupp died. So this 2000 opinion is not even relevant to that. We have to look at that 1995 opinion, and we have to look at what else was in the file. Now, at the time that the veteran died, nobody's contesting he was exposed to Agent Orange. This was before 2001, but he had submitted quite a bit.
But at the time of Mr. Hupp's death,
in 99,
as I recall, there was a joint motion for remand that remanded the matter back for continuing development by the VA, and as a
right.
result, Mrs. Hupp really followed up on that, and that was the result of the later medical opinions, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm still not sure, though. I mean, I haven't seen any case law on that particular issue, but I don't know that that would still be admissible as part of the accrued benefits claim, since it was not evidence that was of record at the time of his death. So,
of course, the attorney for Mr. Hupp at that time did not see fit to argue for a reversal, but rather agreed with the VA that remand was the appropriate remedy for further development.
That's from the file that shows that, yes, that's correct. And that may have been, you know, I have no way of, I was not the attorney, so I don't really know the reasoning behind that. However, on accrued benefits, we have to look at that 95 exam. I mean, if we're looking at what was in the record, you know, he clearly had, there's no question he had a disability. He had CML and he died from it. So we've got a disability. We've got Agent Orange exposure. No one seems to be contesting that. So nexus becomes the only question. Was nexus shown? And that's where we get into this 95 exam, in which, you know, Dr. Luker said explicitly, it is my opinion that because of the quantity, consistency, and duration of exposure to Agent Orange, that there is a relationship between the exposure and his diagnosis of CML. So it becomes important here the fact that the board never really discussed this exam at all. They mentioned it, but they gave no flaws in it. They didn't say, well, this is bad because fill in the blank.
And the remedy would be what if we accept your argument?
On the accrued benefits claim, I think...
Are you
appealing the decision on the accrued benefits?
Pardon me?
What's the decision on the accrued benefits?
That was denied as well.
You were appealing that?
Yes, that's in here as well. Unfortunately, as I say in the brief, that was not clearly delineated, but we state that we're appealing the board's decision to deny the accrued benefits and DIC benefits.
Of course, any arguments not presented in the brief, according to our court's case law, are waived.
Well,
you have no argument on the accrued benefits.
Well, we argued that the board's determination was wrong. We didn't delineate it clearly.
Well, let's get back to the you've discussed for some time the fact that the 1995 examination indicated that there was a relationship between exposure to Agent Orange and the individual's leukemia, Mr. Huff's leukemia.
That's right.
What significance is that, and what would a remedy be if we agree with that, your concerns?
Well, the significance is it provides the nexus for service connection.
Right, and what would the remedy be?
Well, the remedy
in
depends
the face, upon... In the face of the 2000 medical examinations.
Well, if we're going to accept the 2000 medical exam as evidence of the contrary, the proper remedy would be a remand. Now,
Based on
the board's failure to properly account for the evidence in the case.
So
the board
reasons and bases.
Exactly.
Okay.
The board does not really give us any reason why that 95 exam is not probative. And in fact, if you look at the board's opinion, they never even say we find the 2000 information to be more probative. They don't even go that far. They summarize all the information, and then they say what their conclusion is. And, in fact, if you look at the last page of the board's opinion...
May I suggest...
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. Go ahead and complete.
Okay, go ahead.
Subject to my other... I'm looking at the time you have left.
Yes, the
and,
time.
And subject to my other... to the other judges' concerns in this area...
Certainly.
I would appreciate if you could address some of the other arguments that you have...
Okay.
In whatever order you'd like to.
Okay. All right, well, the VCAA becomes an interesting argument here as well, because there's a question when you talk about the VCAA is what does it require? Okay, it requires evidence of what is necessary to substantiate the claim.
What is your definition of substantiate?
Well, that's where the whole thing comes in. We could say that the definition is simply some evidence on each element.
Well, we have said what it is in Dingus-Hartman. We not?
Well, Dingus-Hartman seemed to require a somewhat more than just a generic statement. All right, in Dingus-Hartman, the court said that the notice must provide examples of the types of evidence that the claimant could submit, and where the application suggested that some specific evidence was needed to resolve the claim, the VA should tailor that notice to inform the claimant of what evidence was necessary.
But doesn't Dingus-Hartman speak to the meaning of the word to substantiate? And in doing so, look at the legislative history of the development of the VCAA?
Well, the whole point, if you look at the legislative history of the VCAA, is to...
I'm talking about the words to substantiate, which
right.
are pretty critical here.
Okay, well, I don't have the reference before me at the moment. So
don't we say something like, to substantiate means tending to prove,
right.
as opposed to
absolute
proof.
Right. Well, and that's where the problem comes in this case, because the question is, what was necessary, and was there something necessary?
What did the letter? She received a BCAA letter. Right?
That's correct.
And did not the letter give her information on each element of a DIC claim?
Well, what the letter did was list the three elements.
Right? And what kind of evidence would be necessary?
Well, it said cause of death, death certificate.
Death certificate.
Right. It said injury in service, that's been resolved,
disease.
That's not a question. Relationship between cause of death.
And how would you get that?
A statement from the doctor, that's been submitted as well.
Is that in the letter?
It says you can give us a medical opinion regarding a relationship from your own doctor.
Okay.
And she had provided that as well.
And she'd already provided that.
Exactly.
And would it be over-compliance notice if you keep giving this notice over and over, information she already had?
Well,
that was already in the record?
So then the question is, why did they give this notice at all? I mean, unless it's simply to have a piece of paper in the file. The VA must be taking the position that something is required still to substantiate the claim. Otherwise, it's just a formality. We're saying everybody has to have this piece of paper, so we're going to send it to them.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm curious to pursue another phrase in 5103, which is the sentence that says, that talks about what information is already in the record is supposed to be accounted for in the notice provided. So what do you think that phrase means for VA?
At the least, I mean, a reference perhaps. I mean, what I've typically seen is a reference to the SSC's rating decision, something. If in fact this were given before the rating decision, then I would think there has to be some sort of list. Now, this letter was sent out after all the evidence was developed. You know, nothing came in after this.
Well, there's nothing really
talking at all about what's in the record or what they need.
Go ahead. You say it was sent out after the evidence was already developed.
Right.
Well, I guess that's true. Is there any significance, do you think, that this is a DIC claim, which is a claim separate from, this is Mrs. Hupp's claim.
Exactly.
Not Mr. Hupp's claim.
Exactly.
And all of these medical opinions, well, perhaps not all of them, mm-hmm. but many of them, and much of the evidence in this case was developed under Mr. Hupp's claim for service connection.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any significance in that fact, vis-a-vis the VA's duty to notify under the VCAA?
Well, really, the only evidence that was prior to his death was this 1995 letter. And that was, you know, in the claims file and so forth. Even though the 2000 was associated with his claim, because it was pursuant to that earlier remand, Mrs. Hupp did request them to go ahead and fulfill the terms of that remand. So that's really part of her claim as well. So I don't think there's a clear distinction, particularly with the 2000 claim. I think that
what was the reason that she requested that they do the 2000?
I am presuming from looking at this because the board had previously said, well, we don't consider this 95 opinion to be any good because you don't have any. There's nothing in the record to back it up.
Then why shouldn't the court find that she had actual knowledge of what she needed to actually prove her claim, not even just substantiate her claim, and find a lack of prejudice?
Well, because in the remand that was granted after that, the secretary and the Mr. Hupp's attorney agreed that this was an inappropriate basis.
But further development was done.
Right, but nobody still ever said what was wrong with this 1995 opinion. And, you know, it had been basically dismissed because of not having anything to back it up.
So,
and that basis for dismissing it had been rejected. So now we still don't have anything to tell us what's wrong with it.
If you were writing the notice, if you were the VA writing the notice mm-hmm. on this issue, which I assume is Nexus, is the one we're talking about,
right.
How would you write the notice?
All right, the first thing I would say is, what do we really need here? I mean, you'd have to look at this and really say, no, is there a legal requirement that she provides studies or something to back up her doctor's opinion? That's the first thing, and that's one of the problems with writing this notice. Now, if in fact I was willing to say that you have to have an additional doctor's opinion, study data, whatever, to back it up, then I would say in the notice.
Well, if you say that you're required to have an additional doctor's opinion, doesn't that amount to a pre-adjudication of the claim? Doesn't that amount to it? In order to do that, the VA would have to make a judgment that the evidence of record was not sufficient for her to prevail.
Right.
And is that what you believe the notice is required?
Well, in this case, I would say yes, because all the evidence has been developed. They've already denied her claim twice, and surely they know why they're denying it. So if there's any reason whatsoever to send out a VCAA letter, it ought to tell her why her claim is being denied and what more she needs to provide.
Why?
Because otherwise,
what authority do you have to support that statement?
Well, on that, I'm going on the principle that the VCAA is there to provide information to claimants as to what they need to substantiate the claim. And if the VA feels that there's something more to substantiate it, that's what we need.
You're at your time. I'm going to give you some more time. At ten, when you get, in your 10 minutes,
correct,
you can pick this back up.
Fine.
Okay? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Rebecca Baird. I'm representing the Secretary today. With me at Council table is William Puchnik. I'd like to start by picking up on the issue of substantiation that Judge Hayward raised before, and I wanted to point out that in Dingus at page 491, we did indeed state that, the Court did indeed state that substantiate means to prove, tending to prove or support. So it's the Secretary's position in this case that the DIC claim has indeed been substantiated. This is so because, as appellant's counsel has conceded, she received notice of all of the elements required to substantiate the claim for service-connected death. That being said, it's the Secretary's position that the VCAA notice would not apply to DIC in this case.
And we're talking, you're focusing on the letter that was sent to Mrs. Hupp, when you were discussing the word to substantiate. In this case, the board relied on more than that letter in determining that the secretary's duty to notify was met. Is that not correct?
Correct.
Okay. How does that square with the Federal Circuit's decision in Mayfield that would say reliance on post-decisional documents by the board is improper?
The Secretary would contend that Mayfield isn't on point because Mayfield was talking about VCAA notice, which doesn't apply here since her claim was substantiated. We don't even need to go down the path of what was done under VCAA. At the time, before the April 2003 letter was sent, her claim had been substantiated.
So you're saying substantiated to the extent that there's some prima facie evidence on each element?
Correct.
But not necessarily that it has been proven?
Correct. I'm sorry, proven, I guess disproven is what has happened here. Correct.
So there's no, in that case, there's no requirement to send a VCA letter?
If the claim was substantiated?
Well,
correct.
Take it another way. Is there any requirement to give the VCAA letter if a claimant presents evidence at the beginning that touches on each element of a claim that they are seeking to?
I think that's correct. Under 5103, it says she needs to get notice if the claim has not been substantiated.
And not previously provided would then mean if everything has been previously provided, you would not have to provide notice.
VA would not have to provide notice to her because there will be nothing left. Correct.
So let me get this clear. So you're saying that in this DIC case, in this DIC claim case, the VA had no duty to provide a 5103A notice letter?
She provided evidence of all the elements necessary to prove a service-connected death. So no.
Well, for the sake of argument, let's assume that VA did have an obligation still to provide her a VCA notice.
Mm-hmm.
As in Mayfield 2, the Federal Circuit noted that the timing defect could be cured by the remand, as was done in this case. What does the phrase, if any information and any lay or medical evidence not previously provided, mean to the Secretary in terms of this case?
I'm sorry, may I have a look at 51 and
54? Well, I can elaborate. Does this mean the Secretary has any sort of obligation to review what the appellant has submitted, or in that case the claimant has submitted, and assess what elements of their claim are being touched on by the evidence that they've submitted, and say, you still need to submit evidence on this, you know, and tailor the notice to the information that is lacking by taking into account the evidence that it's already been submitted?
I think that's correct. It would have to be tailored to what is missing, and the purpose actually of the statements of the case and the supplemental statements of the case lays out the evidence that we already have, so that's taken care of there. And I think 5103 is saying we're going to tell you what's missing given all of this evidence that we have.
So providing a generic statement to Mrs. Hupp that you need to submit evidence of cause of death when VA already has the death certificate would not be something VA should have done. It might be harmless, but...
Right, I don't think... Correct. I think it's a harmless error, but I think the April 2003 letter actually was a little more tailored than just being a generic form letter. I mean, it told her that VA would get, or presumably had gotten, service medical records or other service records, that it would review his claims file, and that it would get evidence from other doctors if she identified those doctors. And it told her that she was responsible for providing the death certificate and that she could give any other medical nexus opinion from her private physician.
Right, but by that point, the death certificate was already of record.
That's correct.
So this, in fact, wasn't that tailored to her to note that this was already submitted.
Correct. We should have realized that we already had the death certificate.
So in essence, there is sort of a little bit more of a front-loading of the system than has really been done to date, as opposed to... just we're going to give you the information about the three Kaluza elements that you generally need to submit in every claim, and then once your claim is granted or denied, we'll tell you what specifically you had or didn't have. Instead, up front, VA should be telling people, we have this, you're still missing this.
Well, I think part of that analysis is the statements of the case and the supplemental statements of the case. That is where we tell the claimant what we have.
Yeah, but you don't have a statement of the case and a supplemental statement of the case in every case.
When you've sent the notice.
You do in this situation because
right.
We're, you know, sort of in the flux, believe it or not, after 2000, we're still in the flux of working out the VCAA. And so, you know, this has been up and down. So now here you have a statement of the case and supplemental statement of the case. But if the VCA was to work sequentially as it was required, you wouldn't have statements of the case and supplemental statements of the case. You just have this letter.
That's right. But I think we also, when it comes to notice, we have to look at each individual case and what's expected there.
Okay.
And that's, granted, we shouldn't have told her to resubmit a death certificate. It wasn't necessary. It certainly wasn't harmful. But in this case, there were supplemental statements of the case that had already been issued.
Well, let me ask you about that. It's not harmful. Looking at the letter, which is on page 514 and 515 and 516 of the record, there are a couple sections of the letter, and the first section of the letter is titled, What Must the Evidence Show to Establish Entitlement? And then they go through the Kaluza elements. And they lay out, I think, in general terms. But then when you go over to the next page on 515, they say, there's a heading that says, what information do we need from you? And in that section, I see nothing about a nexus opinion, which it seems to me is the one thing that is missing for her to prevail on her claim. The single thing that's missing from her claim for her to prevail is a nexus opinion that would, in the mix of things, sway the VA from its already established opinion that there's been no service connection.
Well, I would have to back up.
That's not here, right?
I first have to back up a step and say that it's not our position that anything is missing from her claim. She provided a nexus opinion. It just wasn't a good opinion. It's not, it doesn't carry much weight, is what the problem is in this case. I mean, the purpose of VCA isn't to weigh everything she gives us and report on that and, you know, here's why this is wrong and here's why this is wrong. That's an adjudication. That's not the purpose of VCAA.
Is there anything significant about the fact that this is a DIC case and the evidence that was of record when she filed her claim had basically been rejected already?
I'm sorry, any weight as far as VCAA?
Is there any, does that create any different sort of obligation upon the Secretary in informing her of what she needs to substantiate her claim?
I don't believe so, no. In this case, it's at the time she filed her DIC claim, she'd already submitted evidence by virtue of the veteran's claim for service.
Yeah, she didn't submit it. The veteran did during his claim, correct?
Correct.
And that went up through the adjudication process, and the board actually found, even though there was a joint motion for remand, there was a finding that that medical opinion wasn't sufficient to establish service connection. Correct?
Correct.
Let me say it in one. If Mr. Hupp's claim had been finally denied for service connection,
mm-hmm.
yet she still came in after his death and filed a claim for DIC, would the notice have to include a statement that said that she had to provide a medical nexus, death certificate, and a medical nexus?
Presumably, yes. We would have started with the three elements, correct. But I would also note that in this case, the appellant stepped in while there was a remand pending at the board, and she did indicate that she wanted an exam, the basis of the remand. She wanted to continue with that. So we did continue with the evidence that she indicated she would like to have developed, which was the 2000 opinion.
And that, okay, that's right. That was connected to the DIC claim.
I'm sorry?
That was going to be part of Mr. Hupp's claim.
Correct. But he passed away.
She then stepped in and took it as part of her DIC claim.
Right.
And what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that she was aware of what was missing from the case, from the claim. She was aware that the 95 opinion wasn't sufficient, and I believe in her December 99 NOD, she even indicated the basis of that remand. She very well understood the basis of the remand, and she said that she wants VA to present medical evidence on the issue of nexus.
So you're saying that she had actual knowledge under the Mayfield analysis?
That's correct. If we do apply VCA, she had actual knowledge of what was missing and actually indicated that she wanted that evidence developed by VA.
I'd like to go back to something that Judge Green said. I found that sort of interesting. If you think about a DIC claim, the veteran's claim died with him. So she's starting from scratch in filing her DIC claim. So therefore, the 95 opinion that was in the record, in theory, hasn't attached to her at all at that point, because it's his claim.
It may not have attached. I'm not sure how the. It was certainly evidence of record that we would have to consider. I mean, I understand a DIC claim is her claim and not his claim, but it's still evidence regarding the issue of whether service connection is warranted for CMS.
So a DIC claim is unique in that when you come in and file your claim for the first time, you already have all this stuff that comes with you.
Right.
Interesting concept.
Would that mean that in a DIC claim that notice needs to be particularly tailored then to inform the widow or widower of that situation? To be clear about what they need to present to substantiate their claim, since there's already been an adjudication.
Right. Well, I can only speak to the facts of this case. In this case.
No, I know. We were talking about assuming the service connection claim had actually been adjudicated, and there had been found to be no service connection.
Mm-hmm.
So in a DIC letter, somebody applies for DIC, in this case Mrs. Hupp would have applied for DIC after that adjudication. Do you believe the secretary in their VCA notice letter would have been required to inform her that, hey, you've already got an adjudication here that says there's no service connection, so this is where you need to focus on presenting your evidence, whether it be for nexus or whatever reason?
I don't know what the expectation would be if we were starting anew from a DIC claim where the service-connected death had been denied, but I do know that in DIC letters, the appellant is told the reason that service-connected death was denied previously when the veteran filed a claim.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the purpose of the VCIA. I would think that the notice is intended to expedite the appellant's or the claimant's ability to establish whatever benefit it is that they're seeking, that it's to expedite the process and enhance their satisfaction, I believe is the language quoted in Dingus Hartman. So how are those two goals served by merely having them include evidence that you check off from each column as opposed to evidence that is actually sufficient to establish the benefit they seek?
So your question is about the degree to which VA needs to identify?
Well, if you just tell them that they need to submit in-service, current disability, and nexus, and they've submitted a inferior nexus statement as what the secretary perceives happens in this case, clearly they are not going to be able to prove their claim. They're not going to win. How does that serve the goal of the VCAA, which is to A, allow the person to participate in their own appeal or their own case, and B, expedite their pursuit of benefits? If they're not told what is lacking, how do they do that? Oh. How do they achieve that goal?
Okay. The purpose of the VCAA is to lead VA to discover evidence to substantiate the claim. The purpose of VCAA isn't to tell every person how to win your case over and over. Here's why this opinion was bad. Here's what your doctor needs to say in order to win your case. That's not what the purpose was, and I think the legislative history is pretty clear on that, that the purpose is to lead, to help us and to help the claimant identify what it is that's missing and to go to lead VA
to
help
duty to
discover
assist.
That. Correct. It's I think it's going too far to suggest that VCAA looks at the probative value of every piece of evidence. That's the purpose of adjudication. And that's, you know, if someone is denied, if someone's claim is denied, that's an issue that's adjudicated, and they're free to come back with new material evidence and reopen it with a better opinion if they can get one, or, you know, by alleging that we made a mistake in the first adjudication.
Is that concept enhanced by the statement in the Federal Circuit's opinion in Mayfield that you basically get, you're not limited to one pre-adjudicatory notice, but that generally it's not to be kludged together from
right.
a bunch of different pieces. So that's part of your support for the idea that you get your notice one time, not as you dribble in information? Is that it?
I need to be more clear. My position here is that VCA doesn't apply. This claim was substantiated, and we don't need to do this analysis. I thought I was answering a hypothetical.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
In the context of a hypothetical, so the basis for your statement that the VCA applies pre-adjudicatory, not to weigh the evidence, that the weighing of the evidence happens in adjudication, is what?
The purpose?
No, what is the support for your statement? That the reason that... Let me slow down. The reason that you believe, or what is the reason that you believe that the VA doesn't have to weigh the evidence and inform the claimant along the way, that you have stated that that is the adjudication process. What is your support for that statement?
My support would be the legislative history of the VCAA, which specifically said that we didn't, that Congress didn't intend for this to be an adjudication, that it was intended to be guidance to claimants. Those are my words, not Congress's. But it's intended to help guide the claimant and VA in establishing and in developing the evidence in a case. It doesn't take the place of a rating decision or any adjudication.
Go on. Thank you.
Assuming that we don't agree that there's no duty to provide VCA notice in this case, what impact do you believe, or what effect do you believe, the board's reliance on the rating decision and statements of the prior statements of the case has on this case?
If you find the VCA applies, then we would have to walk through the analysis and the April 2003 letter, and I believe the secretary has asserted that all the elements of notice were met in the April 2000.
But if the board relied on all of them and not just on this letter, you would isolate the letter and look at the letter, but the board didn't
Correct.
Rely on just the letter.
Right. Well, I think the Federal Circuit's problem in Mayfield was that we relied on something outside of the board decision and not that the board relied on additional documents and only one of them really provided VCA notice. I mean, the fact that they relied on a statement of the case and a supplemental statement of the case is kind of superfluous because the April 2003 letter actually gave her notice.
So what you would have us do is look at the VCA letter and make a judgment on the VCA letter whether it was good or not.
I think in this case...
Wouldn't that require us to make a factual determination on the weight of these documents about which was more important than the other and which the board relied on and... in its decision about compliance? Because the board didn't differentiate here.
Well, that's correct. They just discussed the statements of the case in the April 2003 letter. But I don't think the court would be erring by relying on the April 2003 letter because the board discussed it. I understand the Federal Circuit had a very finite application of the Chenery Doctrine here, but I don't think you would be violating that doctrine by finding that the April 2003 letter.
Your position is that because it was mentioned in the board opinion and the board considered it,
correct,
among the other documents, that we can isolate that and determine if it was compliant notice.
Correct.
I have another question, and that relates to one of the arguments made by the appellant was failure to pursue obtaining medical documents with regard to the lymph node involvement that Mr. Hupp is said to have had when he was stationed in Vietnam with an advisory group. It seems to me clear from the record that there was a desire on the part of Mr. Hupp to pursue those medical records, and the VA did for a time pursue those. But there are other obligations under 5103 capital A that the VA is required to adhere to when they abandon search for evidence. And I don't see any indication in the record that those were complied with. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
I don't think we abandoned his search for the records. When he testified in the hearing that he was with the MAP 5 compound in Vietnam, he specifically gave us a time frame. I believe it was September to November 1970. And as the hearing officer indicated in the supplemental statement of the case, we did go back and contact NPRC again and specified that time frame that the veteran gave us. And there were no other records submitted. So I don't think we abandoned a claim. In fact, we tried two times to contact NPRC for service medical records. And there were no other records available.
But there's under 5103 big A C, I guess it is, there's a certain information that's required, the VA is required to provide to the veteran when this occurs. Let's see here. It says... I'm sorry, it's in B. Whenever the secretary, after making reasonable efforts, is unable to obtain all the relevant records sought, the secretary shall notify the claimant that the secretary is unable to obtain the records with respect to the claim, and such notification shall 1. Identify the records that were unable to obtain, B. briefly explain the efforts the secretary made to obtain those records, and C. describe any further action taken by the secretary with respect to them. Now, can you point to me in the record where that was done? And number one, and number two, I guess, first of all, is there an obligation of the secretary to do this in the DIC claim? And number two, where in the record is they, have they satisfied that obligation? Has the secretary satisfied that obligation?
I believe it was in the a statement of the case, or a supplemental statement of the case issued. I'm sorry, I should have marked that. I know it's a statement of the case where the hearing officer told him that we have contacted NPRC with regard to the time frame that you told us, and no other records were available. No other records were provided to VA.
Okay, well, I'd like to, if you can locate the record page, I'd like to read that with you, if I could. Because I didn't, in my review of the record, nothing jumped out at me as satisfying that.
At page 171. Says it should also be noted that following the hearing, additional efforts were made to secure supplemental service medical records, especially for the time frame of July through October 1970 for possible treatment of lymphedema while the veteran was assigned to the 101st Aviation Group. However, to date, no additional supplemental service medical records have been filed. In the event such records are subsequently secured, they will be carefully considered in light of the veteran's contentions.
Okay. Now, how does that comply with, say, subsection B, explain the efforts the secretary has made to obtain those records and describe what further action the secretary is going to take with respect to them.
Well, the efforts the secretary made to obtain the records was the subsequent contact with NPRC to see if any other records were available from the specified time frame, and under Part C, this...
Well, it doesn't say anything here about contacting the National Personnel Records Center. It just says additional efforts were made.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, not in the record, and because I didn't notice it and it wasn't counter-designated, is a supplemental contact with the NPRC dated May 1995. I'm happy to provide that to the court, but that's why I know that there was a contact with NPRC. I apologize. It wasn't specifically stated in the statement of the case.
Okay. Well, of course, we can't consider that unless it comes to us in the proper way.
I apologize for that.
Okay.
I'd like to turn a little bit to the appellant's argument, if I may, Judge Hagel, with regard to the Thurber violation she alleges. Please explain to me how the board's conclusory statement, which I believe is in the record at 14, is not reliance on the National Academy of Sciences report. And instead, a interpretation through the doctor.
Well, at page 14, the board does not do a good job of explaining its reliance on the Federal Register, which incorporated the NAS reports. I think page 14 can't be read in a vacuum. We need to look back at
page 12 has an extensive discussion of the National Academy of Sciences recent report.
I'm sorry, page 10 as well. It says, additionally, based on findings in an NAS report, the secretary has determined that there is a positive association between exposure to herbicides and CLL, and then they cite the Federal Register for that proposition. And they should have made that more clear at page 14 when they summed up their conclusions, but they did rely on the Federal Register.
And they don't seem to mention a doctor's statement in that conclusion that leads them to believe that there is no evidence of an association. On page 14.
The 1995 doctor's
statement? Either the 95 or even the 2000 doctor's statement that is supportive of the secretary's position that there is no association.
Correct. They say there's no clinical evidence in their summary, but I think if you look back at their actual discussion of the evidence at page 11, they do note the evidence supporting the appellant's claim consists of the May 1995 statement from the VA physician and as well as the March 2000 opinion from another VA position to the effect that some studies suggest an increase in CML in people who've been exposed to Agent Orange. And then they go on to say, in contrast, the board observes Dr. McCall's opinion in January 2000, where he reviewed the May 1995 opinion and concluded that it was not based on sound medical evidence. I think that the record at 11 is actually pretty good, reasons and bases. They discuss why Dr. McCall refuted the May 1995 opinion, which implicitly is why the board rejected the May 95 opinion.
I'm sorry, would you? I didn't hear the last statement you said about the 1995 opinion. Why do you believe that that discussion meets the reasons or bases requirement?
The board discussed why Dr. McCall in January 2000 discounted the May 1995 opinion.
Point to me where that is?
Page 11.
Mm-hmm.
Page 6 and page 7.
Could you point page 11 where it is that they...
Yeah, what's the language? I understand where they're, where the doctor, his own opinion, but I don't see where there's any explanation of why the 95 opinion is not valid or why we should accept the 2000 opinion over the 95 opinion.
I'm looking at the board's language. In contrast, the board observes that a VA physician reviewed the claims folder and
that just means there's another opinion. It doesn't explain, in my judgment, why the 95 opinion is faulty. It says there are two opinions.
Well, I think we need to look at Dr. McCall's opinion.
No, we need.
If you're talking about R&B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but because it's the board's opinion we're looking at here. I mean, the board is entitled to make a judgment of one opinion over another. There's no mm-hmm. question, but they have to explain why they chose one over the other. And I'm searching for that. That was an argument made by the appellate, and I'm searching for that explanation of why the board chose one over the other. I just don't see it.
Okay, in page 5, where they discuss the May 1995 opinion, they note that it was the opinion of Dr. Lucan, that CML was related to Agent Orange, and that he noted the veteran had dermatitis. In January 2000, on page 6, they note that Dr. McCall noted that there was no evidence of dermatitis, and there was no... then down at the bottom of page 6, they go on to talk about how Dr. McCall discussed there are no clinical findings that CML is related to Agent Orange. I'm out of time, if I may.
Thank you very much. All right, Ms. Michelle, you have an open checkbook here. You stopped on notice.
We did, and if the court wants me to go back to notice, we can continue there, or I would like to respond to some of the points that have been made here. One of the things I would like to talk a little bit more about is this duty to assist in getting the medical records. Now, in the July 95 hearing officer decision, they do say additional efforts were made. They don't specify particularly. I think we also should look in the record at 360. In October, after this cursory notice...
Excuse me. Did Mrs. Hupp make an additional request for those records in her DIC claim?
I don't believe Mrs. Hupp additionally requested it. However, since this has been brought up, I mean, it is relevant information, and, you know, it's part of the duty to assist. If the VA knows that these are things that are still hanging out there, presumably there's still a duty to assist. I realize, again, the case is a little different because of it being a DIC claim.
But you really needed a statement that said that his disease was service-connected.
Well, that appears to be the problem.
However, if in fact there's something in these 1970 medical records that's critical, you know, that would be evidence on the case as well. As I said earlier discussing this, I'm not a doctor. I don't know if that would be a symptom of leukemia that would be showing early, but that's something a doctor would have to review. And that's why it's critical to get these records. And the duty always has a duty, the VA always has a duty to obtain service medical records and to try to get these. And I would just note that in October 95, after the VA said, well, an attempt, we don't know what it was, although, you know, even conceding that it was an NPRC attempt, which I have no reason to doubt.
But 5103, big A.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't in effect at the time that Mr. Hubb was filing his claim, was it?
No. However, I think there's still a duty to assist and to get this information. And my point here is that Mr. Hubb told them at the time in this statement on 360 that it's possible they weren't looking in the right places for the record. So that's of record. That's in the file. VA is relying on everything else that's in the file. This is their, they should have considered that as well and perhaps made some sort of other, attempt to receive this evidence, and nothing was done.
I'd like to return to the VCAA argument, please.
Sure.
How do you respond to the Secretary's contention that there is no VCAA obligation in this case because her claim has been substantiated?
Well, the problem with that is they gave her this letter. Now, if VA believes that the claim has been substantiated and therefore there's no reason to give her this letter, why did they give her this letter? You know, the board sent back a remand saying she needs to have VCAA notice. They sent her a letter. So she's got this letter. She has to believe that there's some point to getting this. So we have to take it that the VA at least believed that there was something left to be substantiated.
Okay, then let's go from there. Assuming
right.
that there was something left to be substantiated, what was missing from what they've told her to that she's still required or that VA would get for her?
They gave her no clue in this letter as to what was required to substantiate her claim. They listed, again, the three requirements.
Did you say no clue?
Well, not really. I mean, there's a clue. We've got the three. You can guess it's one of those three. But the whole point of the VCAA isn't to sort of give a broad overall and say, okay, take your best guess.
How is the letter deficient?
Okay, the letter's deficient because, first of all, it doesn't specify at all what's missing. It simply lists the three Kaluza elements. Secondly, when you look at what they
let's talk about that.
I'm sorry.
Okay, in order to substantiate her claim, and in Dingus we said tending to prove her claim,
right.
Isn't that pretty important to tell her that? That they don't, not only do they state the elements, which are in italics in the
right.
letter, but they also follow that with an explanatory sentence, for example, to give examples of types of evidence that would in fact qualify for each of those elements.
Exactly.
Now, is there a problem with that portion of the letter?
Well, I think there is, because since she had already presented a statement from her doctor, or her husband had already presented, she knew it was of record, again, distinguishing between the two. There had already been presented nexus evidence. It has to appear from this if VA needed substantiate it.
But, I mean, is the question then is whether or not the fact that it had already been presented, is it wrong for the VA to provide this information to her, even though it had already been presented? How is that harmful? That's the question.
Well, I think it misleads her.
Okay, so is your position that by providing, after evidence has already been provided and already in the possession of the VA, that providing this extensive notice is somehow misleading to Mrs. Hubb?
Well, I believe it is because...
And how is it misleading?
Because I believe it's misleading because it leads her to believe that there's something she's missing that she needs to provide to them, but she doesn't know what. And if you look at...
And maybe we might find what under the heading, what information or evidence do you... what can you do to help your claim?
Exactly. And when we look at this, we see that what they tell her that they need is contact information for anyone who has records that they don't have that you think will help us decide your claim. I don't know where you go with that, particularly in a DIC situation where her husband had died 4 years previously. We're not going to have any kind of current medical records. It's not that likely that there is some body of information that they don't know about that's just sitting there that she can tell them about at this point. So it seems like pretty much a pro forma statement. They're tossing something in there because that's kind of a bland, generic, boilerplate thing to say that doesn't give her any useful information. And then if we look down to what can you do to help us with a claim, tell us about anything you want us to get. Well, if you don't know what you need, how can you tell them what you need them to get?
I'd like to go back to your statement about that she'd already submitted a Nexus opinion and that wasn't enough. Aren't you asking the VA to prejudge the quality of her evidence then?
Well, here's the problem. The Nexus opinion had been rejected once, but it was determined by a JMR that it was rejected on legally insufficient basis. So that seems to indicate that it's okay. The board in this case never gives any reasons that there's anything wrong with it. So that makes you think, well, there must be something else. Not that this is in it and of itself insufficient, because frankly, looking at it, it looks pretty good to me. But what else they did? Do they feel that it's necessary to have study information to bolster it?
So your argument is not that they should have told her that her Nexus evidence was insufficient and that she needed to get something different. It was that they confused her into thinking that it was fine.
Exactly, because they didn't tell her what was wrong with it. And so how is she supposed to know what to give them? I mean, looking at these letters, I wouldn't know what to give them.
Okay, then going again with the secretary's argument, let us assume, and also based upon Dingus Hartman, that all substantiate means is that you need something for each column.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're told what's wrong with your evidence that you have submitted in that column mm-hmm. in the statement of case.
Well, nobody ever told her what was wrong with this 95 letter.
But is that a VCAA violation?
Well, that's saying she hasn't been provided with this information, even if you wanted to drag in the statement of the case. And
well, is the information that she's supposed to be provided what is wrong with her 95 opinion, or is it that you need Nexus information?
Well, it's you need Nexus information, but if that isn't Nexus information, and the board apparently does, if you look at the board's decision, they say there was no clinical evidence. So that's not saying this 95 opinion was inadequate. They're saying there isn't any clinical evidence. So the question is, what clinical evidence do you need to establish the case? And if there's something else that's necessary, they needed to tell her this. Are there any further questions? All right, then I'll let my last 4 seconds go.
All right, hold on. Just
oh, okay.
I'll give you 5 seconds back.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Counselor.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. We will greet the bar, and then the court will be adjourned.
Rest, the smoking lamp is lit.